speaker is Rav Olav Ashkolel of Peretz Manas, who's from the Tardi, he's from the scholar there. We'll share, Baruch Hashem, I met tonight for the first time in person. He's been good enough to assist Jerusalem Kosh and Lewis for quite some time, but he was the first Rav who volunteered the services and his experience and knowledge of Kashrus has written a lot of things. Anyway, I'd like to call on Aswin, the Tzibor, to introduce our Manash, who will speak about Kashrut, Hagola, commercial, industrial, and we'll go from there.
It's an honor and a pleasure to be here tonight to share with you some information about kashrus in general. And especially my main goal is there's not going to be enough time to cover every single detail of all the intricacies of Hagolas Kelim and Kashrin. But I mainly want to give an understanding of the logic underpinning the halachas of kashrus. So then, whatever we don't cover, you'll be able to a certain degree, figure out on your own. And at least you'll be able to ask Kasheilas Chacham. I just want to give an introduction, a hakdama, that my main goal here is not to say practical halachal amaisis. That's each individual shayla that comes up. A person has to ask their rav, and especially I understand here we have a very capable rav. I want to trust in the merit asra. And the shayla that come up with amaisis, the people should ask their rav. But I want to give an understanding of the basics so that people will know what to ask and how to ask. So I think we're going to start with the basics, with the very basics of Hagolas Kelim. The starting point is, obviously, there are certain foods that are treif, that are also to eat, which could be many different things. It could be a behemoth that's a treif or a nevela, it could be peiros that are tevel, there's many things that could be also. The Torah asks eating the object itself. The Gemara learns out that there's a concept of tam ki'ikr. Even if one doesn't eat the actual object that's treif, however, eating the flavor of it, if say it was cooked together, let's say someone took treif and meat and cooked it with potatoes, and now the potatoes have a flavor from treif and meat, so the potatoes are also aser to eat, and that's called tam ki'ikr, that the flavor has the same halacha as its origin. The maskon, the machlokes rishonim, but the maskon of Shulchan Aruch is that tam ki'ikr is a din d'oraisa. So if someone would eat that potato that has tam osir in it, he's over an isser deraisa. Not only do potatoes absorb flavor, but kalim, utensils, vessels, pots, spoons, also can absorb flavor. Therefore, if someone cooked something that was not kosher in a pot, or in a kosher pot, or if he, say, stuck his spoon into the pot that was cooking non-kosher food, or if it spilled on his countertop, or it was cooked in his microwave oven, or whatever the example may be, we're concerned that now it has imparted a non-kosher flavor into this pot, spoon, microwave oven, whatever the case may be. And we have to remove it, because if you would then go and cook a different kosher food in this pot, or stir it with a spoon again, etc., it would now acquire this non-kosher flavor. And then it would be also midoraisa even to eat this second kosher food, previously kosher food. The makar for this is from two different places in the Torah. We learn at number one from Milchemes Midyan, that after the Yidden made a milchama against Midyan, and after the maisa of Galpa'or. So then Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu to tell the Yidden that all of the kelim, all of the pots that they captured from the Midyanim, they have to kasher. They have to either burn them in fire or boil them in water. Whatever each thing it's appropriate, Allah, as we'll get to soon. But you have to clean out the pots, not just clean them, but you have to remove the bleas, the absorbed flavors that are in them. Additionally, regarding karbonis, it says that if someone cooked a carbon in a pot, if it's the pot has to be cleaned out from the bleas. Either if it's washed out with hot water, if it's a kli charis, it has to be broken. So we see from two different places in the Torah that if a kli absorbs flavor that is not kosher, that's treif for whatever reason, that's osur, so then the pot, the bleas, the flavor must be removed from the pot before the pot is used again for kosher food. There are two main different ways of removing tam, the two which are also three really, the main ways of removing the tam from these utensils. The first way is Hagola. Hagola would mean immersing something in boiling water. What does that accomplish? The same way the flavor went in when the food was cooked in the pot. What happens? Someone, let's say, cooked trefa meat in a pot with water. So the flavor was came out of the meat as it was cooked, and some of that flavor was absorbed in the walls of the pot. Next time when we cook in the pot, so the water in the new food would remove some of the flavor because there's a constant transfer of flavor in and out of the pot. When one does Hagola, when we put water in the pot and we boil the pot, that it's actually bubbling. So that is assumed that it removes all of the flavor that's in the pot. All of the tam, all of the flavor, both the trefa flavor, whatever kosher flavor may have been in the walls of that pot, will now come out into the water. We've now removed the flavor from the pot. The problem is, where's the flavor? It's now in the water. Now you're still, the pot's still in the water. If it was a spoon, you put the spoons in the water. That tam is going to go back in. So there's a couple of conditions we're going to need to make sure that the pot will remain kosher and will not become treif again. But the basic understanding of Hagola is that by boiling water in the pot, we remove the tam iser from the pot. Now, in order to affect this, as we mentioned, the water has to be, pashtus of Shulchan Aruch is the water has to be actually boiling. There is a machlokes. There are those who are mekel, but for now, lechatchila, certainly the water should be physically actually boiling at a rolling boil, not just little bubbles, but a strong boil. Certainly, if the water is boiling, that is sufficient. It'll be a cool. In certain cases, it'll be a cool if the water is boiling. What case would that be? There's some cases where the original bli in the pot may have been at a hotter temperature than boiling. Now you ask, how could that be? Because water can only exist in a liquid form up to 100 degrees Celsius under normal circumstances. So how did the blis go in hotter than 100 degrees? So there's a couple possibilities here. Let's say it was a deep fryer that became treif. Oil boils at a much hotter temperature than water. So the blis may have gone in at 110, 120 degrees Celsius. Now boiling water that's only 100 degrees Celsius. But still, we accept that boiling water will remove all of the blis. Another example would be a pressure cooker. When the water is under pressure, it will remain in liquid form considerably above 100 degrees Celsius. The blis may have gone in hotter. It's not necessary to do Hagola in a pressure cooker. A Hagola can be done in a regular pot that's boiling. A third, maybe more nitpicky difference would be, let's say someone cooked the Isra in the pot in Bnei Brak, at sea level. Then he brought the pot to Yerushalayim, which is 700-800 meters above sea level. There's less air pressure, water will boil. I don't know the exact, but now you're saying 99, 98 degrees Celsius, because of there's less air pressure. So when you're doing Hagola, it's not going to be the same temperature that the pot absorbed the tam Isra. That's still okay. Boiling water always removes all of the tam from the pot. What's going to be, though, if you created a vacuum in your pot? There are certain circumstances commercially where to save themselves energy, rather than save them their heating costs, they'll create a vacuum in the pot. And therefore, the water will boil at a much, much lower temperature. It might be 60 degrees Celsius. It might even be 40 degrees Celsius. One example where this is commonly done, which isn't really our topic today, is when they extract salt from seawater. They'll do it in multiple pots where each one is a lower and lower pressure, and therefore lower and lower temperature. The seventh pot, we often use six or seven, can be boiled. The water can be boiling at 30 or 40 degrees Celsius, which is not even Yad Sered at this point. So really what that's relevant for is the question of Bishlach or Bishl on Shabbos, which is not our topic. But in such a case, it's accepted in the Paiskim that less than Yad Seredis is certainly not going to do Hagola. What's going to be between Yad Seredis and, let's say, 95, 98 degrees, that's not clear in the Paiskim where the borderline is. But you could do Hagola in a pot in Yerushalayim, even if it was cooked by Bnei Brak or even in Yam HaMelech. That is accepted. We don't have to be medactic that it should be the same altitude. Fine. The other way mentioned in the Torah of removing the blias from a pot is libun. Libun means burning it, putting it in a fire. when does this need to be? This is obviously a more difficult and also a stronger way of cleaning out the pot. When is this necessary? It can always be done. Something that needs Hagolah, where it was boiled in the liquid. Hagolah is required, is usually used when something, when the Isra was boiled in a liquid. And in that case, Hagolah is sufficient. But let's say the Isra was roasted on a barbecue, for example. So then, since the Blias went directly, under a more intense heat, without the intermediary, without the medium of a liquid, so then Liban is required. And Liban would be a blowtorch or potentially a self-cleaning oven, certainly a matzah oven. It's generally accepted it has to get, for Liban chomer, it must get up to about 900 degrees Celsius. 900 degrees Fahrenheit, I'm sorry. When it which the Gemara refers to as nitzaitzos nitazim, that sparks will fly out of it. At that temperature, we assume that any blias inside the kli are completely burned up, and they no longer exist. They're turned to a crisp, they're burned out, there are no blias isser left in the pot. There's a second form of libun which can be done, which is more lenient, it's called libun kal. This can be done, number one, on something that requires, that really only needs Hagolah, but for various reasons it's not practical to do Hagolah. Let's say it's too large to fit in a pot. Let's say it's difficult to clean, as we'll mention soon. So then there are certain cases where Liban Kal can be done. Another case would be if the pot of Batson is Hatcher. I want to transfer it from Milchud to Fleishig, but it's kosher. So there, to transfer from Milchud to Fleishig, I don't really need to get out all the Blias. I only need to weaken the Blias enough that it will create an Isser of Basar B'chalav. For that, I can use a lower intensity heat. That needs what the Gemara of Shani referred to as kash nisraf me'achayrif. If a straw meaning like a blade of grass, not a drinking straw, will be placed on the opposite side of the, let's say, metal from where the heat source is, it would burst into flame. We know the kindling point of paper is roughly 450 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's generally accepted about 450, 500 degrees Fahrenheit is hot enough on the opposite side, that's called libun kal. So those are basically the two, three types of kashering that can be done. There's Hagolah, there's Libun Kal, and there's Libun Chomor. What are the differences? So as we mentioned, Libun Chomor burns up the Blias. Hagolah removes the Blias into the liquid. Libun Kal is a machlekes what it does. If it removes the Blias, if it draws them out, or if it burns them up inside the pot. And there will be significant differences how you understand it. One specific nafkamina, one difference that comes out of this havana would be that since Hagolah, as we mentioned before, we have an issue with Hagolah. We've taken the blias out of the pot, but where are they? They're in the water. The blias, as the pot's hot, will go back into the. So the blias that are in the water, the isra in the water, will go back into the pot. So how have you kashered your pot? So we said we're going to address it. Let's address that. Hagolah is going to require one of two things. Either the water will have to be at least 60 times the volume of, let's say, the spoon you're kashering. That way, even if the spoon was full of blias, the entire volume of the spoon, let's say the spoon was 1 cubic centimeter, so a maximum couldn't have more than a cubic centimeter of tam isser in it. Probably is much, much less. But we're always going to be concerned about the worst case scenario. Worst comes to worst, there's 1 cubic centimeter of tam isser in the spoon. If there's more than 60 cc's of water in the pot I'm using for Hagolah, so it would be batel b'shishim. So even if the spoon was full of tam isser, but all that tam isser came into the water, it's now batel b'shishim. It's not, the water is not osir. So even now, as the water circulates and goes back into the spoon, but the spoon will remain kosher. That's one way of getting out of the problem. The second way of getting out of the problem is to do Hagolah on a spoon or pot that has not been used for treif for at least 24 hours, called the Eine Ben Yoymai. Why does that work? Because we only say tam ki'ikr, we're only concerned about a flavor when there's a flavor by itself. There's no actual tarfus here. There's no actual iser here. There's only the flavor of iser. Now it only concerns us if it's going to impart a positive flavor into the previously kosher food. If it's going to make it taste bad, then it doesn't concern me. So for example, common example would be, waiter, there's a fly in my soup. Right? So obviously you don't want the fly. You take out the fly. Flies are awesome. But what about the soup? Do I need to make sure there's 60 times the volume of the fly in my soup? The answer is no. Because a fly is assumed that it gives a bad flavor to the soup. It doesn't give a good flavor to the soup. Right? Certainly people would not want the fly in their soup. So, therefore, I'm not worried about the flavor of the fly in my soup. If there's not 60 times the volume of the fly in my soup, the fly may have, in fact, imparted flavor in my soup. But since it's negative, it doesn't make the soup awesome. There's a general rule, a general assumption, that any tam that's in a pot for 24 hours, in a kli for 24 hours, is going to be stale, and it's going to impart a negative flavor in whatever else is cooked in that pot. So if I've waited 24 hours since the spoon or the pot became treif, before I kasher it, whatever flavor goes from the pot or spoon into the hot water is going to be a negative flavor. It's not going to make the water usser, and therefore I'm not worried when that flavor goes back into the pot. So you'll ask me though, I don't understand. If it can't make it usser, so why did I have to kasher the pot at all? Because the pot itself, even though, let's say I wouldn't have kashered the pot, and I would have gone and made a vegetable soup in this pot that yesterday I by mistake cooked treif and meat in. So what's wrong with the vegetable soup? The vegetable soup's not going to be ulcer. Because the pot only gave a negative, you're right, the pot may have given a taste of meat, which was treif and meat into my vegetable soup, but it made the vegetable soup taste worse because the meat was stale. The tam yisr was beiner ben yaymai, it was old. So the answer is midoraisa, you're right. Midoraisa, if I would have cooked vegetable soup in my 24-hour-old pot, the vegetable soup would not become osir. However, it's osir l'chatchila midrabonim to cook in a tray for pot, even if it's only going to give a negative tam. So therefore, I have to do agola. However, since the tam comes out, and now it can't make the water osir midoraisa, midiavid, now it's going to go back into the pot, is going to be two steps removed from the original iser. It's called not barnat, and it's not barnat de heteru. So it's two steps removed from the original iser, and it's now, it's according to the letter of the law, it's mutter. So since it's indirect tam of heter, we're not concerned about it anymore. So that's the two ways of making hagola work. It's always going to have to be that the pot or utensil either is at least 24 hours have passed since you last used it for treif, or alternatively, you have to ensure that there's at least 60 times the volume of the utensil in the liquid, in the water. Fine. So now we've gotten over those limitations. We understand that. Now that is only going to be relevant as we were, this is how we got onto it, because agola is removing the flavor into the water. However, libun, which just burns up the flavor, does not have either of these two limitations. There's no need for any 60 times anything of the spoon or the pot, because I don't need to be mevatel, I don't need bittel on the tam. And additionally, I don't have to even wait 24 hours, because I'm burning up the tam. There will be no tam left when I'm finished my libun. So neither of those two things will apply.
Yes. Is there a time limit by hagola? How long the pot's in the water?
It has to be in there for a couple of seconds. There's no, it can't be in and out in a second. There has to be enough time that the blias could come out. We don't know exactly how long that is, but we generally assume that when it's boiling, when it's a rolling boil, that a couple seconds is enough time. There's no specific. Yeah, I can't tell you 5 seconds, 10 seconds. But it shouldn't be in and out in a second. It doesn't have to be there a long time. Okay.
Sure. Well, when something becomes tray,
yes,
then there's no time limit. Even if something touches it for a second.
Right. If the iser touched the head for the pot for a second, you put your spoon in it, it goes. Right. We're going to assume that the spoon...
It's an area until everything's going to be on everything.
Right. Something went in and we don't know how much, so we'll worry about the worst case scenario that maybe it totally saturated itself with the Isser, and it has to, we need Shishim against the whole thing. Even though, yes, you're right, practically speaking, it's not likely, but we're always... The Rabbanu, we have to be worried about the worst case scenario. Yes.
We have a kosher at half-half.
Could you, let's say you had a long, let's say a ladle, and it doesn't fit in your pot, so you do half and another half, yes. Sorry. So he asked if Hagolah can be done half and half. Let's say I have a long ladle and I want to do Hagolah on it in a relatively short pot. So can I do half of the ladle, take it out and do the other half? The answer is yes. However, I should just point out that there's a qualification that in between the two halves, you should rinse off the ladle and dry it before putting in the second half.
Why is that?
Why is that? Because there may be droplets of water on the ladle that are the issa that came out, so you want to rinse those off. And we want to dry it so that any droplets of water remaining will cool off the boiling water. Fine. So that was another important rule in kashering, and that's kiboyloi kach poltoi. The way the tam went in is the way it has to come out. This explains why we mentioned previously that hagolah is required on something that absorbed through cooking, and liban is required on something that absorbed tam through roasting. If the tam went in with a liquid, it can come out with a liquid. If it went in through a dry, direct heat of the fire, it can only come out through a dry, direct heat of the fire. Just reiterate what we mentioned previously, since liban is stronger, if it absorbed tam through bishul, through boiling, it can be kashered through liban. It's just not necessary. There are certain cases where one may think it absorbed tam through a liquid. For example, a frying pan, where we generally, the Ramah, at least after Minhag Ashkenazim, is to require liban. But that's because we're concerned that it may be that the oil evaporated or was absorbed in the food, and there was direct contact between the food and the pot and the frying pan without the intervention of oil. Yeah, so for example, that would not apply to a deep fryer, only to a frying pan. So that's the classic example of kibbele kach poltei. The method which the tam went into the pot, whether dry or liquid, is the same method by which it must come out. Furthermore, if tam went in through a kli rishon, let's say it was in through a pot that was on the fire, someone cooked a pot on the fire by mistake with chayfa meat in it, then the only way to do hagolah is with a boiling pot that is on the flame, on the fire itself. However, let's say the pot of treifa food spilled onto something, so that was iri kli rishon, it was only poured from a kli rishon, so that hagolah can be done by pouring on this treifa object from boiling water in a pot. If the bliya was only through a kli sheni, then it's enough to do hagolah in a kli sheni. It's generally best to do everything in a kli rishon, and it's the most straightforward way of doing it. However, the halacha is, the way it went in is the way it comes out. Now there's a question, how far do we extend this rule, the way it went, kibbele kach poltei, the way it went in is the way it came out. Will that also apply to temperatures? Now as we mentioned previously, certainly the chumrah, if it went in through a deep frying of hot oil that was hotter than 100 degrees Celsius, it's not necessary to do hagolah with hot oil. It's sufficient to do with boiling water that's going to be cooler than the tam went in. And also we mentioned with air pressure and pressure cookers and whatever. I'm sorry?
How much Celsius?
Boiling oil? I don't know exactly, but oil boils at a significantly hotter temperature than water. I don't know if it's 110 or 120 degrees Celsius. But if you deep fry treifa meat in your pot, in your deep fryer, it's enough to kasher it with water that's boiling at 100 degrees Celsius. You don't have to boil oil at 110, 120 degrees Celsius. Reb Moshe says that it is sufficient, in Igros Moshe, that it's sufficient to apply this by hagolah also to the temperature. Let's say I would know that this pot absorbed the tam iser at 80 degrees Celsius. it would not be necessary, would not be essential to boil it, to kasher it at 100 degrees Celsius in a rolling boil. It would be enough to raise it above, to fill it with water, and raise the temperature above 80 degrees Celsius, and if it went in at 80 degrees Celsius, it will come out at 80 degrees Celsius. Everything that went in will come out. Under certain circumstances, though, you does rely on this. There's some times where you have machinery where it's not practical, it's very difficult to get it up to 100 degrees Celsius. For example, let's say you have a machinery with lots of piping, and it's carrying whatever, let's say pasteurized milk from a holding tank to the heat exchanger, which is where it's brought up to pasteurizing temperature, which is close to boiling. But then it goes from there to other tanks, it goes through piping to the other side of the heat exchanger, which will cool it down, and it goes through numerous piping, much of which will be Yad Seira Dispoy. It may even go to a holding tank while it's still Yad Seira Dispoy. Now, that means, say, the piping in the holding tank only may have come in contact with milk at 80 degrees Celsius, 60 degrees Celsius, 50 degrees Celsius, which is Yad Seira Dispoy. So it's hot enough that the flavor would have been absorbed in the walls. However, since the heating element, the direct application of heat when you want to kasher it, is only going to be at one point, and all these pipes are only going to be receiving heat further down the line, they're not going to get to 100 degrees Celsius when you boil it. So under certain circumstances, Rav Moshe B'Shas HaDechak does allow that. No, you, again, under certain circumstances, will permit this. It seems to be accepted by numerous Vadei Kashrus. L'maisa is, Pashrus Shulchan Aruch does say that Hagola must only be done at least L'chatchila at water that is a rolling boil. And it must remain a rolling boil even when you, let's say, for example, you're putting a smaller pot into a large pot, it's going to cool off. And it may have been a rolling boil before you put in the smaller pot, but it's going to cool off and it'll stop boiling. You do have to leave it in long enough that it will resume boiling and be there a couple seconds before you take out the pot. Because at least l'chatchila, the water, Shulchan Aruch says the water must be a rolling boil. So there are circumstances, b'shas adchak, where we can be mekel on kibay lekach poltei, but l'chatchila, the water must be a rolling boil. Yes.
So, if you're doing Haggadah and you put something else in, can you add a piece of iron that's hot to make it boil? Is that...
You could do that, it's generally not necessary. If we're talking about...
No, because the way it has to boil is longer. If you have a hot piece of iron right. Or another burning, and you just put it in and that makes it boil.
If it's really boiling, as long as it's not bubbles from the piece being thrown in, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hour before you
start
bubbles.
Correct.
Which I meant is the major issue to stop production for a whole day.
Right.
Can you run the production on cold during the 24 hours?
Theoretically you could, it wouldn't be practical. I mean, if this is, whatever the factory is, if it's producing, if it's built to work on hot, it's not going to have anything to do with it on cold. So it would not generally be done. But what is potentially done under, again, not l'chatchila, but b'shas adchak, is, as we mentioned, if you wait 24, why does waiting 24 hours work? Because now it's meisim tam l'fgam. The flavor it gives off will be a negative flavor. Let's say you could run through the system hot water mixed with ammonium or some other noxious chemical that will impart a negative flavor to the machinery and any bleus that would come out. So then, again, under certain circumstances, we can't allow Hagola without waiting 24 hours, because it'll be nice and tam l'fgam without it. There's a lot of details of why it's not an ideal situation, but under certain circumstances, it can be done. But running cold, I don't think, would be in general practice.
Right, the
question
is,
sure.
You put this on another pot, so what do you...
Usually, so what you'll do is you'll the larger pot you'll fill not to the top. Assume the larger pot will be a kosher pot. You'll put it on the fire till it starts boiling. Once it's a rolling boil, you'll throw in the smaller pot. You'll place it out.
So what if you trapped up the big pot?
If you trapped up the big pot, okay. We can get to that now. We can mention that now since you brought it up. I don't have a specific other good place to mention it. Now, the Gemara says you do with an extremely large pot is that you build up with clay or with dough a lip around. The problem with the big pot is simple. Let's go. The starting thing, the simplest thing to do should be fill it to the top, boil it, and now that's how it absorbed. It absorbed from the inside, and you should be able to take it out by boiling water inside. The problem is going to be the lip. The lip inevitably was splashed, was splattered on when it was originally cooking. If you just boil the pot for 5 minutes, how do you know it's going to specifically splatter on every point where it originally absorbed the isser from? So that's problematic. So the Gemara says to build up a lip of clay or dough. The Gemara says dough, but for Pesach you're not going to use dough, you're going to use clay around the lip. So now I can fill it all the way to the top and a little bit above the natural lip of the pot. And then I boil it above that lip. The place can give a different case, which a different solution, which they say is a better solution, is to fill it to the top, bring it to a boil, and then, as the lady mentioned before, is to take a red-hot rock or piece of metal and drop it in, that it will overflow all around the sides of the lip. Now, to do that, there's still a couple of things. So the advantage of that is that now I know that I've had a flow of water all around the lip. Of course, that requires the pot being completely level and carefully lowering in this object that is not just going to splash over one side or the other. Now, so those two are surmountable problems, but there's a couple other difficulties with it. Number one is just practically, when you're splashing that much boiling water, it can be dangerous. So it's not practically recommended for danger reasons. Another problem is that if the pot had originally, it's certainly possible that the pot had received splatters of isser on the outside. If it was splattered on the outside, so the hagol on the inside does not necessarily remove all of those glias, and you would want a kasher from the outside also. Now, when it overflows, it's not reliably going to cover the entire outer... It may cover the whole lip. It won't reliably cover the entire outer surface of the pot. So you could potentially kasher the inside of the pot that way and then do iru. You could pour from a boiling pot on the outside. Or you could do libud on the outside. Or you could do libud on the whole pot once you're at it. Or I would even suggest is, I don't know the arrangements in Beit Shemesh, but I know in Beit Hal where I live, there are certain places where once a month, usually Arab Shabbos Mevorachim, they have a communal Hagolas Kelim, and there they'll have a huge pot set up for Hagolah, and it might be worth waiting till then. If you can't wait, so then you'll have to find a different solution. But theoretically, you can boil over the pot. For practical reasons, it is not always it's not always ideal.
Because the pot tray clean or something, we have to be concerned that maybe we have gone on the outside of the pot as well.
Or
you're saying
in
a specific case where
if you cooked on the inside, you don't necessarily have to be worried.
It's not,
if I don't see
the wall of the pot isn't one thing from inside to outside, that you don't have to worry about the outside.
If you know that it's splattered on the outside, if you know it's splattered on the outside, you should do have go on the outside also separately. Okay.
So you have to do if you do Haggadah, so the outer pot that you use to do the Haggadah, he's asked you if you have to worry about caution in that. I thought that was his question.
I didn't understand it that way, but if that is the question, so we'll answer that. Well, if that wasn't his question, so that's your question. As long as we'd waited 24 hours and there was, or there was at least 60 times the volume of the smaller pot in the water, it is not necessary to kasher the outer pot.
I tried to have a little bit of pot.
Okay.
So I have to, and I have a bigger pot, but it has to be kashered in a bigger milk pot.
It should ideally be kashered. If you want it to remain, to go back to being milchig, it should be kashered in a pot that is of the same, whatever you want to call it, same category as the same gender as what you want the pot to be when you're finished.
A pot
How do you recommend making this red hot stone?
I personally, if you don't have experience doing it, I'm not sure if it's recommended because it's dangerous. But the simpler, if you want to do it, the best, what I've seen done is using a good tongs to put it on a different gas burner on the gas range, turn up the gas and place it, if it's on the burner, it will get very, very hot. It doesn't have to be red hot. The main thing is, in this case specifically, what I really want to do is I want to make the large pot overflow, and I don't want to put in something cold that will cool off the water that will stop boiling. So it doesn't have to be specifically red hot. We're not doing Liebert on the stone or on the piece of metal. The point is, it should be something that's going to cause it to overflow without cooling it down.
Would it be possible to instead of a stone, to take a smaller pot, put it on a burner, and let it get very hot from the bottom, and use that to insert into the pot to cause it to overflow?
It's a practical concern. If that would work, you know, you don't want to ruin your pot by putting it empty on a fire. And it has to be hot enough that when you put it in...
I had some liquid in there. In other words, I filled it part of the way so I won't ruin the pot. And got it, kept it
on
the fire.
So probably if you have a liquid that'll keep the temperature of the walls of the pot down, it'll be liquid...
I'll put it inside to boil.
Right.
And it'll be still... I'll put on the fire for 10 minutes or so, 5, 10 minutes, whatever it is. The inside liquid is boiling. The bottom of the pot is hot because it's been sitting straight on the burner. Mm-hmm. And immediately take it... insert into this pot that I'm trying to kosher and use that to cause the overflow.
Theoretically, there's no problem. If it'll make it overflow without stopping boiling, it'll be fine. You just have to make sure that the practicalities are worked out that that's going to happen.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I just went to the hardware store and asked them for a piece of iron. They bent it in an L, mm-hmm. so it would stand, and I stood it on the burner and I took the pliers. Right. And that was easier to control.
Than a rock. Okay.
Than a rock.
Yeah, there we go. Piece of metal will work perfectly fine. Okay. Now, since we mentioned that you need kibbele kachpoltai, so with Haggolah, and the way Haggolah works is that it's removing the tam from the pot by the contact of the liquid, so there are certain issues that come up. One of Moshe was asked, can Haggolah be done with steam? Will steam remove the bleis? And Reb Moshe is very reluctant. Reb Moshe says we can't rely on steam. At least part of the reason is because you don't have that contact with liquid. You have steam hitting it and going on. It's not necessarily going to remove, because what Haggolah has to do is just remove all of the tam from the pot. It's not necessarily going to do that. What Reb Moshe does say can be done, though, is if you're using what they call a steam jenny, or here I guess a kitoran, if you steam it so long that the outside becomes covered with a film of water, and then you keep doing it till the steam causes that water to boil, that will at least be like a haggolah in water. You'll be doing haggolah in the film of water, not in the steam itself. But to do haggolah in steam is not posh. It's not, Reb Moshe does not allow doing that. Which then creates a halacha issue besides the practical issue with kashering microwave ovens. Microwave ovens is something everyone always asks about, kashering microwave ovens and using them for milchugs or fleishigs, or someone who works, let's say, in a not-from office, if they can use the office microwave to heat up their food. So there's a couple considered. Number one is, theoretically, if you double bag your food would be great, and it would work, except that the teva is, the way microwaves work is, that they work on the moisture that's in the food, and they create a lot of steam. As the steam rises off the food, it creates a lot of pressure. It's very likely to burst the bag, or to open the bag, or to rip the bag, and then you'll end up with all the steam coming out, and you haven't accomplished anything by double wrapping your food. So number one is, you've got a practical problem with double wrapping. So it's not. I personally would not recommend someone use a microwave for milchigs and fleishigs double wrapping, or use a tray for microwave with wrapping. Another consideration would be, let's say the microwave did become tray for. I want to switch it. So the question is, can I do a go? I'll wait 24 hours. I'll clean the inside of the microwave, and I'll put in a cup or a bowl of water. Turn it on high long enough for the pot to boil. and to cup to boil and fill the whole microwave with steam, and you could say kiboilei kach poltai. But there's a couple problems. Number one is that I think the most analogous case to this that's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch would be the lid of a pot. The lid of a pot is absorbing tam through steam. How do you kasher the lid of a pot? Not just by putting it on top of a boiling pot. You have to immerse it in a kli rishon itself. You have to do agolin kli rishon. So the most analogous case for the microwave, it's not enough to just steam it up, you have to boil it. As Reb Moshe mentioned, because steam is not a simple way of doing agolah. It's not necessarily going to draw out all of the tam. It will draw out some tam. So therefore, the steam that rises will absorb some tam from the roof of the microwave. As it fills up with a cloud of steam, it will bring it back down to the food, and it may impart that tam into your food and make the food awesome. But it's not necessarily going to draw out all of the tam to kasher. So that's number one, a halacha issue with kashering a microwave. Beyond that, there's a practical issue. Is even if you scrub your microwave clean and you can get in all the cracks and crevices, which is necessary always before doing agolah to make sure it's completely clean, but there's almost all microwaves I've seen have holes in the back that lead to a fan that draws out the air to circulate the air. There's no way you're going to be able to clean the fan blades that are behind those holes. And you certainly could have had trefa steam that was drawn through the holes and then adhered or caused bleus inside there, which you won't be able to practically clean out. So it's another reason why, practically speaking, I personally do not recommend cleaning microwaves, kashering microwaves, and using them either for milchus and flations or using a trefa microwave. Yeah.
With a double bed, if you make a small hole, yeah. Let's say steam does come out of that little hole, but the steam is going out, not in. Is that enough?
Theoretically, yes. Let's say someone came and said, you know, I made a mistake. I tried double bagging my food, and the bag burst. And I right away noticed it and turned off the microwave. But let's say there was a small hole and steam was escaping. So now what's the concern? The concern was, did enough steam hit that it could can draw out the tam and come back to the food? There is room to, if such a thing happens, there's room to ask the Rav, and it may be that the Rav will be matter. However, I wouldn't recommend that as something you'd want to be doing l'chatchil on a daily basis. My opinion, I wouldn't recommend it l'chatchil. Happen to the Eved, ask the Rav, and you may be able to, the Rav may say it's mutter, but I wouldn't recommend it. Yes?
My experience, usually the size of the microwave usually don't reach yet to less, but even though the food's extremely hot,
right?
I tried putting my hand in touching the sides, and so in that situation, is it safe to assume that the microwave not to tray for not to come place just as close to the microwave?
So you still have the consideration of... Sorry. The question was that if the walls of the microwave do not become very hot, so then... Can one assume that the microwave never became treif because the lid, whatever hit the microwave, was cool enough that it would not? Tam flavor is only imparted when something is above the temperature of yad seledes boy. Has to be hot enough that the hand recoils from it. If the walls of the microwave don't get above that temperature, so maybe there's no bleus at all. That's a good question. But that's why I was really talking about kashering microwaves. This still remains the practical issue that I mentioned of the fan blades could have on them actual particles of trefa food. That issue would certainly remain. I have personal experience found that sometimes if the food is moist enough and you left it in long enough, the roof of the microwave can get yad seledes blood. So if it didn't get yad seledes, it could be that you wouldn't have a problem. But again, I wouldn't recommend that as something you'd want to be doing on a regular basis. If there's a shas of chak or whatever, ask your off. But I personally would not recommend that on a daily basis.
So when somebody says you can kasher a microwave with boiling
Or they're saying that you're going to have enough liquid that the roof of the oven got coated with water and then the steam reboiled that water, potentially. But we're also not going to liquid mush. Yes.
Why in general, we talk about going to double wrapping things, Why is it so double
that? It's a good question, but I have enough. I put it this way. I'd like to finish on time. I'm happy to answer you afterwards. I want to finish on time because I don't think I have enough material. I could speak for 3 hours probably. I'm sure no one here wants to sit through 3 hours. I believe that it will not go much over my hour. So not more than 5 minutes, I hope. So just side points after that. What? I should answer? Okay. Fine. Okay. If there's a single... The question was, why do people mention double bagging things? And not why wouldn't a single bag be enough? In this case, with a microwave, it would only be a practical consideration, that one bag would be more likely to open than a double bag. The reason double bagging is often mentioned is because, let's say I have something in a single bag, and it's coming in direct contact with something trafe, so the trafe will go through to the other side just like it would a pot. So if something trafe touched the outside of a pot, the food inside the pot will absorb flavor through the wall and the food will become trafe. If there's a single bag, so the flavor can go, let's say, for example, a simple, a classic case would be an airplane meal. Airplane meals are all double bagged, because double wrapped, because they're heated in the same oven as the trafe meals. Why? Because if steam from the trafe meals or residue from a trafe meal would touch a single bag, so now that bag would be osir, and any food touching the inside of that bag would also become osir. Because flavor, tam, is imparted through a kli to what's touching it on the inside. However, tam does not go from one kli to another kli if there is no food or liquid in between them. So if you have a double bag, so the outside bag will become treif. If, let's say, in your airplane meal, the outer wrapping is now treif, but it can't make the inner wrapping treif. So now the food that's touching the inner wrapping will stay kosher. And the outer wrapping should not be used. You should not let hot food touch the outer wrapping of your airplane meal. But in the microwave oven case, it would really only be a practical consideration. Okay. Let's get on to some important. There's a very important... So we mentioned the Hagolah, we mentioned passing, but we have to emphasize, before Hagolah, the pot must be spotlessly clean. It's very important. If you can't, if something that can't be cleaned, so then the only way that then libun kal would be necessary. It would be necessary to heat it with a fire to the point of kash nisraf me'acharev, approximately 450-500 degrees Fahrenheit. This would be very common when you have a container that's made, you have a kli that's made of multiple parts. For example, an oven with a knife with a separate handle, pots with separate handles. If the handle is so tight that it's impossible for any residue to get in between the handle and the blade, hagol is enough. But you have to clean it till it's absolutely certain it's completely clean. Otherwise, libun would be necessary. And on those plastic handles on your pot, they're not going to survive libun. You'd have to take them off and clean it, or come up with some other problem. It's a big things that are different parts are a big problem. But if you can get it completely clean, if there's no gap, it's okay. So that's important. We mentioned it has to be 24 hours since it was last used for treif. Or alternatively, you have to have at least 60 times the volume of the treif spoon or whatever pot in the water. We mentioned under extenuating circumstances it would be possible to use ammonia bleach, something like that, to make it pogum. There's a very, very important halacha that I think many people do not know in Agolas Kalim, and it's something that creates problems on a regular basis, from what I've seen, especially in commercial and industrial settings, is this halach of chayis. It's two. There's a couple of places it comes up in Shulchan Aruch that if you were reading Shulchan Aruch Mishneh Berurah, you might not realize the implications of this halacha. But I want to tell you, if you understand the reasons behind these, see from they're very, very relevant. Shulchan Aruch tells me that if you have a kli chayis, you cannot do Hagolah or Libun on it. Something of pottery, the blias never come out. The only way to do it would be to put it back in the kiln that was used to fire it when it was originally made, or a different kiln. Theoretically, if you would fill it up with coals, if you take a pot pottery pot and put glowing coals inside of it, that should be enough. However, you're not allowed to do that because we're worried that you won't do a proper job. You'll skimp on how many hot coals you'll put in because you're afraid the pot will crack. Now, between me and you, I don't have any pottery pots in my house. So I might think, well, it's irrelevant. There's another halacha. It says that if you have a knife, or if you have a kleen made out of ivory, or a knife that handles ivory, you can't do hagola on it. Why not? Not because it's like chayes, the bleeds would come out. But ivory is delicate. And if you would do hagola in boiling water, it might get ruined. So we're worried you're either going to make the water a little too cold, you're not going to put it all the way in, you'll take it out too quickly, and you won't do a good hagola on it. So these two things also, I don't personally do not have any ivory utensils in my house. However, it's very important. There is a yisoid here, there's a rule that it applies to any circumstance where a person is going to be concerned that by kashering their utensil they might ruin it. You're not allowed to kasher it, and if you did, b'dieved, you're not allowed to use it. And this would apply by many things. So for example, I was really going to mention it later, but let's say plastic. There's a machlokes on plastic, if plastic can be kashered at all. But even if is it like cheres, or is it like other things, where the bleeds do come out. However, even if cheres can be kashered, if it's something that requires kashering in a boiling pot on the fire, there is concern that people will be reluctant because plastic can get ruined. And boy, if it's not heat-tempered plastic, it could get ruined, and a person might not do it properly. So in the end, if it's something that's not heat-resistant plastic, it can't be kosher. Another example that comes up on a regular basis, that comes up is, it's interesting, with doing libun, not so much in a home, but let's say something is made out of steel and needs libun. I didn't bring it with me. But someone who works for them, you gave me research he did. There's many different types of steel. Steel is an alloy of iron and cotton and carbon and different other metals. And there are many different types of steel. We're familiar with stainless steel and whatever, but there are many, many different varieties of steel with slightly different compositions. Some of them are stronger but more brittle. Some are a little softer, but they don't break as easily. Some are more heat resistant. Some are less. But all of them, since they're alloys, they're mixtures of different metals. At a certain temperature, they'll start to separate out and lose their strength. What temperatures damage steel? Roughly, all different varieties different, but 950 to 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. What's the temperature we said for Libun Chomer? 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, to do a proper Libun means you have to get every single inch of this pot or whatever it is glow at 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Every single inch of it, if it has to get to that temperature. If you're taking your blowtorch and going inch by inch and getting it up to 900, are you going to be able to be careful you don't get it to 950? It's very risky. So that means that if a person's going to be constantly worried, I don't want to get it too hot because if I get it too hot, I'm going to ruin it. Or a mashgiach in a factory who's coming into kasher their machinery, and the owner's going to be looking over his shoulder saying, be careful, don't get it too hot, you're going to ruin my steamless machinery. So then it's a problem. It's a big problem kashering if you can kasher it at all. I remember someone from there, you took me on a tour of the Hyatt Hotel in Manhattan. If I remember correctly, it's in the same building as Grand Central Station. And in the kitchen there, he showed us the grill. And he was explaining to us how careful you have to be to kasher the grill. The way they kasher the grill is they spread charcoal, glowing hot briquettes of charcoal all over the grill till the grill glows red hot. And that's when you get it up to the right temperature. But he explained to us you have to be very, very careful. Because they have a very sensitive fire protection system. They have a sprinkler system. If it gets above a certain temperature, it'll trigger the sprinklers. It'll alert the fire department. It'll shut down all of the water and electricity in the entire hotel. And it costs hundreds, if not thousands of dollars for the company to come down and reset the system. So you have to be very, very careful you don't make the grill too hot when you're doing it. So now you get into a very dakistic situation. I mean, obviously the Rabbanim Nachshirim there, who are big Talmidei Chachamim and Yerei Shemayim, allow him to kasher the grill. So we have to draw a line between, I asked him, how can you do it? why doesn't this fit into the sif of chayis? So he explained to me that the way the Mashkiach explained it, I don't know if that, I did not ask Ravelsky or Herschel Schachter their explanation. The way Mashkiach explained it is, he wanted to say there's a difference between being nervous and being careful. This is something you have to be careful. Shulchan Aruch is answering something that you're nervous about. I just want to point out it's a very fine line, and it's something that Vatikashas has to be very careful on their policy, how they're dealing with such an issue. I'm not coming to say that anyone's doing something wrong, but it's something that is they have to be worried about. We as the consumer, I think, can rely on them if it's a good action. But it's something they have to be worried about. Fine. That was interesting. Another interesting thing that comes up on the Kibbele Kachpolte issue is there's something called a spray dryer. Oh my God, I'm pretty pushing my time. Okay, so let's skip spray dryer. It's not so worried. Not something that's going to come up to us. Microwaves we covered. Dishwashers is something people want to know. Can you kasher a dishwasher? So a lot of people are aware of the fact that Moshe has a couple of truths where he does allow kasher in a stainless dishwasher. Baruch Hashem, today most dishwashers are not enamel on the inside, they're stainless steel. So people might think, great, you can kasher dishwashers. But there's a problem, because your Moshe holds, at least, that you cannot kasher plastic. As we mentioned, there's a machlokes. But for Moshe holds, you can't kasher plastic. Oh, every dishwasher I've seen today, first of all, has plastic pieces. Whether it's where you add the salt, or where you add the detergents, whether it's the tracks that the runners go on, there are plastic parts there that, according to Rav Moshe, cannot be kashered, even if you run it on high, and even if you throw a glowing hot rock into your dishwasher, which I wouldn't really suggest either. There's an additional problem, practically speaking, is that every dishwasher I've seen has a trap, has a filter that catches particles. So you have to be sure that that is spotlessly clean. You have an issue, is there any possibility that you could have food residue down the piping that the hot water will go down and then back up back into the dishwasher? So while Reb Moshe's fact that the dishwasher theoretically can be kashered by running it on the hottest, practically speaking, it's not something I would recommend. Yes?
I'll
pass on that one. I just want to cover one or two other important points, since I think I'm really pretty much at the end of my time. But kashering countertops, or tables, if necessary, is something that there's a couple of issues here also. Theoretically, a countertop, you'd say, you don't cook on the countertop. You don't put a countertop into a pot like a spoon. So what does a countertop have? Higher the maximum it should have is iri klirishin. You may have spilled onto your counter from a hot pot. So you should be able to just pour boiling water on your countertop. And that would be simple. But there's a couple issues here with the countertop. Number one is you have to make sure that it's spotlessly clean. To get the groove, the seam where it meets the wall, and especially where it meets the lip, and where it meets around the sink is very difficult. It's difficult to do. So it's a practical consideration. If you can do it, great. There's another issue. Most shayish, the best of my understanding, is not pure stone. Pure stone can be kashered by hagolah. Shayish kesar, for example, which is ground up stone mixed with some kind of adhesive, so that is going to have a din more like charis, more like pottery, which we mentioned, cannot be kashered. So even kesar pashas cannot be kashered. Regular standard shayish, whatever the standard shayish you're getting, you have to know. I have heard, I do not know, I've not researched it, but I've heard that most shayish is not pure stone. They have not cut these huge, long, thin slabs of granite out of the mountain. They have somehow processed smaller pieces of stone to stick them together, in which case the adhesive could potentially be problematic. That's really, if that's true, that's the biggest problem. So therefore, for example, for Pesach, I would not recommend someone, I wouldn't recommend someone kashering their stovetop, their countertop, and not covering it. Once you're covering it, cover it with something that's strong enough, and then you don't need to kasher it. Some people, the chumrah, they kasher and also cover. If that's your minhag, so you can do that. And then you don't really have to worry about all the reasons I'm saying to be concerned about kashering, because it's only a chumrah anyway. Let's say, though, by mistake, trefa food spilled on your counter, or even more likely is, by mistake, milk, hot milk spilled on your fleshy counter or the other way around. So now you're in a b'dieved situation. I'd be reluctant to tell you that you have to replace your kitchen shayish and you can't kasher it. So the way, assuming we can get around the problem of not being pure stone, you would want, there's another issue here, though. And the issue is, in addition to eerie creation, there potentially is dover gush. I wish I had time to get to all the explanation, background of why dover gush is mechamer, but for now you'll have to take my word for it, that a solid object that comes out of a klisheni and lands on your counter, out of a klirishon and lands on your counter, according to many paiskim, retains the halach of a klirishon and does not become a klisheni, and therefore eerie would not be enough to take out the blias. And since that may have happened, we want to do our goal in a klirishon. Now you can't take your shayish and insert it in a boiling pot. So the best thing you can do, which is what you have to do according to the Ramah, not according to Mechaber, not for Sadim, is that you pour a pot of boiling water on, and you simultaneously use a red hot rock or something similar to make sure that the water is boiling on the countertop, and then that is more or less equivalent to a true Kli Rishon. It is not the same as a Kli Rishon. Something that needs Hagola in a Kli Rishon, it was something we know was primarily cooked in a Kli Rishon, that would not be enough to do Iri with a red hot rock. But for a shayish where it's only an occasional maybe, there was a dover gush on it, it is enough. Fine, I did say I would cover, so I'm just going to very quickly run through what things you can and can't kasher. Metal is the classic. Metal can be kashered whether it's hagol or libun. Wood can be kashered with hagol. Please don't do libun on wood. Plastic, and by extension formica, is a machlekes apaiskim. Rav Moshe is machmir. Many paiskim are makel. Ask your rav what you should do. Let's see, what else is there? Glass, I think many people know, is a machlekes the mechaber Ramah. The Ramah is machmir, they're considered glass. Oh, let's just start. The classic thing you cannot kasher, as we've mentioned in passing a couple times, is cheres, pottery. You cannot get out all the blias. Glass is a machoikis. The machaber takes one extreme, is that it's not belay at all and doesn't require kashering, just cleaning. The Ramah takes the opposite extreme, he's concerned that it might be like cheres. Ashkenazim are generally machmer for the Ramah. Some places can say that that's only for Pesach, not for Yisra the Hatter. Ask your rov what you should do. But that's glass. Pyrex and Duralex, there are some people who are concerned that since it's not pure glass, there's other things added. Some people say there's boron added. It's a metal, so it should be like metal. Even the Mechaber should agree it needs Hagola. If you look into the chemical composition of glass itself is only 72% silica. Duralex is 80%. So they both have other chemicals added to them. My personal opinion is, therefore, that since they're both primarily silica, and it's only a minor difference in the other minerals added, that there's not a significant difference. Many places can hold that way. Ask your rav what you should do. But my opinion is that Duralex, Pyrex are essentially the same as glass. And in a circumstance where glass can be kashered, then Pyrex could also. I think we've covered China. Is that porcelain is a big machlekes paiskim. It goes back way back, and it's generally accepted not to kasher on a regular basis under extenuating circumstances. Ask your rav. Any other? I think I covered all the important points. Anyone has other questions can ask me afterwards. But I want to just release anyone who it's been enough because I already spoke over my hour. And I'll answer as many questions as you want afterwards.
Okay, let me just officially close this year. Rob's willing to stay because I'm the head. I'd like to thank those of you who attended again. Next week in Yitz Hashem is Moshe Flumenbaum, who will be addressing Inyanei Stam. We'll be speaking about Sefer Torah, mezuzahs, things that are going on in the shuk, things to worry about, things that we should look for. For me personally, I'd like to thank Manash, and I think at the very least everyone should have understood A, capturing this series business. I know for the few times I was privileged enough to take part in different hotel settings,
It's a very humbling experience to see how much Rabbanim know, halacha l'maaseh and halacha, what's involved. And it's a very humbling experience to realize how badly people can get burned and messed up and destroy expensive equipment. So before you start trying to cash your home, you really need, I mean it, you really, really need to know what you're doing. It's a serious business. Chas v'shalom, you can try to cash something and land out with a medical emergency. Anyway, I'd like to thank Rav Manash and those that want to stay and go for the questions as long as he can deal with them. Simcha.
But the sherry casks have not been used for sherry for more than 24 hours before the use of this. So one might say it's a waste of time, it can't pass. However, since the sherry certainly is still giving up some positive flavor to the whiskey, they're doing it for a good reason, so then it would not have the capture of this time being able to. There could be another reason, Rabbi is not for other reasons, but not for that. It's for the Rabbi's matter because Yain Nesef doesn't need Shishim, Rabbi is only 6 times the volume, because it loses its status of wine. The same way you can't make Kiddush on wine that's diluted with more than 6 times as much water, the same way the Isra of Stam Yainim will go off because it's not wine anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Something is diluted to more than 6 parts water and 1 part wine, it isn't wine anymore, and there's no such stuff. That's basically the question.
Back to the question of the metal sink. So, plus 24 hours, she can't use any hot water. You use hot water. Now, let's say just plain hot water. Is that a problem? I mean, you're not, let's say you're not, there's no problem.
So plain hot water gets us into a basic problem.
Why is that? What does the thing I want to do? It reads
it draws out the time,
and then it goes
back.
Put it back in. And then it's as if the 24-hour start to all over again.
Now the truth is coming. Now the truth is that it really is not so harsh. So it's really, for example, according to Saudi, you shouldn't apply by any kind of possible colleges. And pay yourself a macro. But for regular, for the trade tariffs, you should. The Ramo would be not. Spanish. Because we, and that means we look at the waters of the environment of Israel itself, and that was going in this time of region, right? Regional flavor. Whereas if you look at its secondary flavor, it's not
very
sure.
It's very, very clear. That's a very clear.
Yeah, porcelain. One sink of porcelain. And there's a switch on the thing about certain.
hot water got in there with asar.
So what do you usually use? Usually use an insert? Ideal kind of insert, or at least to take like a rack, like I would say a cooling rack. And I have like wire racks, get something out of the oven to put on the shelter, put something like that in the bottom, so at least the pot and the dish won't come in direct contact with the sink. What Meister of Moshe says, without any of that, it will not become trash, assuming it is clean. It's a little bit complicated, but Ramesh explains because the hot water coming out of the faucet is at most an urine clearishin. Assuming you're good, is a clearishin, so the water is an urine. It's only going to be an issue directly where it hits the sink. Wherever it spreads out beyond that is already... It's not a direct urine, it's already a secondary urine. So then it can't draw out Tom and also put it into. It could draw out Tom, but it can't put it into the plate. So it can't make your plate awesome.
There's nothing with the steam or anything like that that comes up from hot water. I'll say there's a pour boom, boom, from boiling water into the sink.
So again, if let's say you were there, let's just scoop out of it. Let's put a spoon on the floor of the sink. And a direct flow of hot water hit on the spoon and on the sink simultaneously, yes, you would have a problem. Assuming the sink can be used for hot, you know, for 24 hours of freezing hot flesh. If not, it also would be within 24 hours. So, practically speaking, you're probably not going to ask in your face. But it's certainly preferable to find some way.
It's only if it's just let it boil.
Which is also there's a huge range of what places are. You got to remember anything above 45 degrees Celsius, not 110 is Yatsu Hadis. But it's all right. Anything above 100 Celsius, not 110 45 Celsius, 110.
Am I correct in understanding that it's not Isser, like the Elfish of Leishigs, but you don't need it in Binyama? But the whole reason of Eno Binyama is because it's Leishig Tambe. It's Leishig Tambe. If it had there, then you won't need it. Theoretically, if I'm kashering from Milka to make it back bar, or if I have.
Because it will already be done on the free. What the Eid HaBinyayim is accomplishing is
it's not by not, but if it's only milk,
I don't remember offhand seeing it, but it's been a smart. The logic is conversation.
And also, I had an issue once, a number of years ago.
In general, I was surprised that there are places in the world you should not cash it from milk to inflation, in general, because you might get confused with it.
But think of a case, it was a different case. If I had like a inflation pot, and then that's the Eid HaBinyayim, and then I went and used it for milk by accident. So you have to go and kasher it. But it's not treif inside because it has fleishig and milchig, but the fleishig was in the binyomer.
Right.
So then I was told that there's a side to say that therefore it's not considered isser inside. It's fleishig and milchig all in the pot that we can that's considered the heterah ball. It was a fleishig pot, but there's milk in it, but it's not necessarily Israel inside the pot.
I don't remember.
So therefore, either I could like not question in Binyama, or in the case that if it's a frying pan or something like that, then it would not.